Hey, Brennan.
Hey, Alan.
How's it going?
It's a little behind schedule, but it's going.
Well, neither rain nor sleet nor dark of night will well, actually, no, I guess the thing that finally killed the post office was Saturdays, right? Wasn't that? Didn't we learn
Right.
that a couple weeks ago? Anyway, thanks for coming around for another Not a Thing podcast, everybody. It's good to be back in the saddle, as it were. We dropped a day due to mysterious illness, but I think we're back on track and we're ready to get going. We don't.
Now a legitimate podcast with our
Yeah.
logo.
Yes. I'm enjoying our new logo. We have to put pen to paper and try and get some more physical goods out of that. Take this enterprise which costs next to nothing to run and then like actually generate some expenses for it.
Ooh.
Can we claim those expenses on our taxes, you think?
If only we knew an accountant somewhere out there who
We
could answer
probably
said questions.
Have to register it as like a business before we could do that. And then
That sounds like a lot more work than a podcast should be.
right. And that'll probably incur some kind of fee which would destroy any profits that we would have made from. Oh, it's always something.
We'll have to check with our financial advisor.
Right. Hopefully soon.
Maybe after tax season.
Yes. Excellent. Well, in case he wants to make or we want to make like a ridiculous amount of money, apparently we should get in good with some casino security workers. There was an article this week about a guy who I think it was through I don't think the game was poker, although it may have been. I don't know. It's a little odd to me because poker is one of those games where you're not really playing against the house, you're playing against other people. But the outcome was that this guy took something like $3 million from a casino through gaming at a
No, it's
cas
32 million.
32. Okay, I was off by an order of magnitude. Whatever, that's fine. Little math here and there. It was through. He somehow had someone who was feeding him information that came from the cameras, which are all over the casino floor. I'm sure you've seen all of the various like TV shows and commercials about, hey, we have so many cameras. And I guess what was surprising to me was that someone had supposedly had access to the cameras remotely. So it wasn't like it was an in, well, I mean, it was probably an inside job, but it wasn't so inside, like someone was sitting in the security office and like texting the guy what to bet or whatever. It was someone had remote access to the cameras, which I feel is broken. Like, you
Do you
should
think they
not.
use go to my PC or something?
A fine Citrix product. I don't think you should have remote access to cameras. That's why they're traditionally called closed circuit cameras. It's because it's closed. Like, you shouldn't have access outside of the security system because stuff like this happens. So I thought that aspect of it was kind of funny. But it goes to show for me anyway that you have to the way to beat the system, while technology is definitely at play there. Someone gave that person access to get in remotely. So it's still all about who you know.
Networking people, get on
Yes. Social engineering is a much more effective method than any kind of direct access hacking I've found. You can always kind of find someone who can help you out,
So, what
as
you're
it
telling
were.
me is that I could rob a casino for millions of dollars just using Go to My PC and LinkedIn?
Wow.
No?
No, the Brendan's statements do not reflect The positions of the Not a Thing podcast.
Or the companies mentioned. Someone call Brad Pitt and find out.
Right. Or, I can't remember the name of the guy who was, Kevin Spacey.
Right.
But, who was it? It was Kevin Spacey.
Actually, it would have been Bernie Mac, but that's going to be a hard call to make at this point.
Oh, yee. Ah, we need that technology. No, I was thinking of the guy that wrote Burning or Bringing Down the House, the book that the movie 21 was based on.
That boring movie, 21?
Very loosely, so loosely based on. The book was okay. It was a little over-dramatized, if you can believe it. But yeah, it was, not the only thing, but one of the best things from that movie was when they showed the sequence of people, the kind of checks and balances of who watches who in the casino, mm-hmm. I thought was nice.
The Watchmen.
Right. It was shot really well, but yeah, the movie was not wonderful.
They should make a parody of The Watchmen where it's like Rorschach and Night Owl and they all work in a casino. In casino security. So like that crappy show with James Caan, Las Vegas, but with The Watchmen.
They just need to do more stuff with The Watchmen. That would be fine.
Yeah.
Although maybe not call it The Watchmen, because I think tying it to that that comic was kind of
the Watch People.
Yes.
That Alan Moore would sue the crap out of you.
No, he. I don't know if he would actually sue them. He would just be extremely bitter about it and disown it. Like,
okay, that's fine.
Yeah, because that's what he did with.
But keep James Caan,
right?
From Las Vegas. Keep James Caan. Get rid of everyone else. You could have Dr. Manhattan playing all the pit bosses, so he's just, like, naked, but he can replicate himself all over the casino.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That could work.
Silk Spectre, Cocktail Waitress.
A little too on the nose, maybe. speaking of interesting costumes... There was an article this week about kind of talking about steampunk, and it calls it the steampunk movement. I'm not sure I would go so far as to say it's a movement. Whenever I think of a movement, I think of something more politically minded. I just think it's a fashion choice. It talks about why steampunk is important and goes to refute a couple things about steampunk in general, that it's inherently because it kind of glorifies the kind of Victorian England and the technology around that, like the rise of steam as a you know, and the Industrial Revolution, the kind of major complaint against it is that that's also the era of rampant colonialism and like racism, which I think...
Right, but if that's anything glorifying anything of, you know, before this century, that's gonna be a part of it.
So I don't know if that aspect of it is necessarily the big deal. I mean, are you familiar with steampunk at all, or
vaguely? Yeah. I know there was a giant steampunk spider in Wild Wild West.
Oh, not
that. I'd like to think that's not the most accurate representation of the steampunk culture.
Maybe not the best example, I agree. did you play BioShock?
I did not.
Oh, okay. That's a good example. Go play BioShock. It's essentially glorifying, like, and kind of, or it seems to be like if steam evolved as the method of powering everything instead of electricity, so it's kind of updating that and bringing it into like a semi-present day kind of thing. So there's lots of dials and brass fittings and, you know, pressure vessels on everything, and everything shoots steam. It's like, so that was one thing about the in the article, which I really liked, talking about how if everything were powered by steam, it's kind of the way steam works in a mechanical sense, and in a way that you can describe it, you can, like, everyone has the capacity to understand that. It's, there's force, there's pressure, there's motion, whereas everything with electronics now is so miniaturized and so arcane to everyone, even to people that understand what's going on. So it's saying that having kind of a steampunk kind of vibe or understanding about stuff is one kind of an interesting method to go through from a fashion perspective, but also, which I think is what most people encounter subculture wise, but I think it also highlights people's, like, kind of want for something that they can understand and something that can be grounded in things that make sense, which I think is neat. I mean, I know for me, I definitely feel, you know, the pressure of technology kind of on a constant basis. And the way that I've been kind of dealing with that is really looking for ways to be kind of more analog or more connected to stuff that doesn't necessarily involve electricity.
I'm such a hipster.
Well, I do ride a bike. I haven't
ridden
a bike.
I don't want a steam-powered iPod.
Yeah. Well, so that's
like a terrible idea.
That's things that I've seen, you know, people, like, not actually doing, but, you know, pretending to do, right? You know, they if you go to any kind of comic convention, say, or any kind of thing like that, there are people cosplaying in kind of steampunk kind of stuff.
Lots of goggles and,
yes, exactly,
lace frilled leather stuff. I mean, it seems very non-environmental. So, I mean, water, fresh water is a precious resource in a lot of areas on the planet. You know, that seems pretty wasteful.
Well,
now, solar punk, that's what I want to see. I should have solar punk.
You're just someone covered in, like, panels, reflective, yeah, panels. And they would turn towards the light as you walk around. That would be kind of cool, actually.
I'd like to think of it as like a still suit from Dune, but, you know, covered in solar film.
And have nothing to do with recycling your sweat and urine into drinkable water.
No, no, no. That's all part of it. It's all conservation.
Wow, you're going to go that extra mile? I'm.
it's better than the Waterworld method.
Ooh.
I trust a still suit way more than I trust Kevin Costner's science.
Oh. Well, yeah. So I think the steampunk stuff is interesting. It's a neat article. But I also like the idea, which they don't really touch on, about how subcultures are kind of important. You know, they're specific about the steampunk subculture, but I think
podcast
those,
listeners.
Yeah. I mean, I think those kinds of things, you know, make for a richer overall kind of culture if you can cherry pick, like, interesting things from each thing. Right? The it's just more to add, you know, richness to an environment. I mean, it's I think the
tapestry of culture.
Yes. It's too easy to, you know, to have that. Everyone has a smartphone, and all of these smartphones look almost the same. So what do you really gain from having, you know, this crazy iPhone versus that Android phone versus whatever? I mean, it's there's a lot of ways to be kind of faceless in this culture, and it's more interesting to me
it's the most faceless thing in the culture.
Yeah.
And it is a shift towards all this technology. Is people communicate using LOL. That's 101. You're talking like a computer. Stop it.
Very good point. Very good point.
Not a thing. Don't even bother running your congressman. Just stop.
Text your congressman.
Mimeograph your congressman.
Send it by facsimile.
That being said, I do think that solar punk should be a thing. We need to figure out how to make that happen. Start a new subculture.
Solar punk is pretty cool. I'm sure that could get worked out. You just need like an Arduino to divert the panels, you know.
Or no, you just wear those sweet like Elvis rock star space suits from that movie Sunshine. So it does kind of look steampunk, but it's solar punk.
Oh, but you have to have like the gold.
Exactly.
The gold face kind of action. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Solar punk should be a thing for sure.
Go ahead. Start cosplaying it, people.
Another thing that that kind of fits with that is there's some new kind of advancements in wearable computing in the last couple, you know, days, weeks, whatever, I guess. At South by Southwest, there was a blitz of people from Google wearing Google Glass kind of to everything. There were a few articles about that, which I thought were funny about, you know, just does wearing Google Glass make you an asshole was one of them, because you're essentially forcing other people to kind of interact with you in a weird way because you have this thing which is feeding you information constantly, and if you're the other, you're another person on the other side of that screen, and you don't, you know, you can't see what they're seeing. They're getting information that you don't have, so it's kind of putting you at a weird disadvantage. I thought that was an interesting kind of point of view of it, but really just talking about wearable computing in general, it mentions stuff like how the you wear enough of enough, I guess, threads of stuff when you're wearing clothes. There's just essentially like a network of fibers. I mean, really, actually fiber, right? not fiber mm-hmm. optics, but right. I mean, you could potentially turn clothing into a fabric for computing, and that would make computers much more accessible and available.
So would that make fat people smarter?
There's more bandwidth.
More powerful computer. Yeah, there's more bandwidth to work with there.
I think you could an argument could be made for that. Sure.
So it's sort of like small, medium, large, 2XL. That's like processor size. Like, oh, you're only a small. Ha! You got a quad core shirt.
And then if you wear like layers, it's like parallel processing or something.
Yeah.
But one bit of it, which I thought was really interesting, was there was a circuit that I guess can be printed, and then put on as almost like a temporary tattoo. So the circuitry, the pathways can be printed onto something that can transfer onto skin, and then be placed there and still carry a charge. I mean, they didn't really show like what kind of fidelity you could have with something like that, but it was completely flexible because it's the traces that that carry the electricity are embedded into that kind of fabric, essentially, that can be pasted onto skin or whatever. And the application that they had for it was like it could just be a thing that when it's in the sun, it's photosensitive, and when you've gotten enough sun based on your, you know, the melanin content in your skin, which it could also read, it could light up or otherwise tell you, hey, you know, you've had too much sun, get back inside before you burn. Of course, if you're the kind of person to, you know, tape something onto your skin to try this kind of thing out, you're probably really pasty and should not be out in the sun in the first place. I thought it was a neat kind of application. I think making circuits flexible is something that will really make wearable computing make sense. I mean, right now it's very much you're wearing a thing, right? They counted the fuel band as wearable computing. I'm not sure if I would go so far as that. It's really just a sensor.
It's like having a calculator on your watch is wearable computing.
There we go. Oh, my Casio calculator watch. I was ahead of the times. That's all it was. Or I was a big nerd, which really has not changed. So
those things aren't mutually exclusive.
Yes. Yeah, wearable computing maybe in the future.
And just because you're not pasty doesn't mean you wouldn't wear one of those things, I know.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I think wearable computing is not necessarily because you're wearing it that makes it interesting. It's just that it means computers are going to be more ubiquitous and kind of in stuff. And so computing power is going to be more kind of in everything. And that gives the potential for more things like computing on the fly, of doing things to optimize how you move or you walk or you get from place to place or process, you know, what's happening in the world around you. I think that's cool. I'm less into the stuff about, like, oh, I can make my tie light up.
No, not a thing.
I don't really see that as the pinnacle of wearable computing.
No.
So from really interesting, like, heavy computing things to much, much lighter computing stuff. Did you see the article about the swarming bots?
Yes, I did, and I don't think it's a light subject at all, Alan.
So the short form was that a researcher was trying to figure out how, you know, when fish swarm or bugs or birds flock or anything like that, there's this kind of large, almost hive mind mentality around it. I mean, we've never really figured out, like, how that works. Like, do all the birds somehow talk to each other as they're turning and moving in these kind of cool and intricate patterns? And so what some researchers did was they just broke it down to a very simplistic robot, kind of this little essentially motor that could move in a very random way. And they put them into confined spaces, and they found that there were, at least in this instance, there were two kind of modes that the robots would get into. It was either a one where it would kind of spin in a circle, or one where it was kind of moving in straight lines. And what was interesting was when you put them into a confined space, they kind of bump into each other and into the walls and just kind of look random. But if you confine the space enough, or if you put enough of them in that space, they would act kind of in concert, or they would seem to form a kind of equilibrium pattern. So, like, the spinning ones, they would eventually bump into each other enough, and then after a short amount of time, they would align to moving kind of around the edge of the circular boundary. And then
herd behavior.
Yeah. And then same with the ones that moved in a straight line, they would all kind of line up and run against the same wall after a while. And it was this really interesting...
Interesting is a word, or perhaps creepy is another one.
Right. I mean, I think it's cool that they would do that without necessarily talking to each other. So that's the interesting thing to me, is that it's not necessarily a, you know... a hive mind consciousness that causes them to move in a not necessarily a hive mind consciousness that causes them to move in those ways, but I think knowing that they will kind of, things will naturally kind of move and kind of equilibrium out means
nature
that you
finds
can,
a way.
Right. You can program a hive mind that can utilize or use. Oh, God, I said utilize. I'm really, really sorry, everybody. Utilize, not a thing. Please don't use that. That's really, really bad. I've been in too many meetings again this week. But you could program a hive mind that uses the natural kind of tendencies to turn into that, to be more efficient than it would be, which only opens the way to, you know, what book was that? Stephen King's, was it Prey? Is that the one that I'm thinking of?
Probably. You might be thinking of Tron Legacy. You want it more efficient.
Yeah.
We'll see how interesting it is when the other shoe drops and crushes humanity beneath its heel.
I think that's been a running thing on this podcast. Or rather, a thing which should not be a thing on this podcast.
Well, it's one of my buttons, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
No. I don't want to be dominated by robot overlords and penguins suck. That's what I bring to the show.
Cool.
This is my soapbox, and I will use it as I see fit.
Well, interestingly enough, the... I guess having some kind of intelligence around TV ratings is finally kind of aligning into a more appropriate kind of method. They figured that kind of aspect out. Something that we've talked about numerous times on this show is that the idea of ratings as they were, you know, 30 years ago about TV ratings and stuff like that is really outdated and really just wrong. I guess is the right word. And I think now companies, content producers are finally kind of getting the gist of that, because there was an article in Wired that talked extensively about how the Nielsen kind of rating system has tried to keep pace with people's viewing habits, but it really doesn't capture the picture of what people are watching or doing or anything like that. And the technology that they're kind of injecting to kind of catch up with that is still just wrong. Like what I thought was interesting was that it used to be that they would give everyone a TV diary, or not everyone. I mean, it's the Nielsen families, quote unquote, it was like every one out of every like 20,000 families or households would get a thing like, hey, you get to be a Nielsen family. And then they would have to fill out a diary of what TV they watched.
No, it's not even one out of every 20,000. It's 25,000 for the country. 25,000 households determine what stays on TV.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. But yeah, so the article talked about how in order to, because people can be wrong about what they watched, they were trying to think of ways to use technology to kind of capture what was there. And so they would put like a camera that would watch who was sitting in front of the TV, and then it would be aware of what was on, so it could catch like, are they really watching it? Who's watching it in the family and stuff like that. And I just think that's it was really silly, because the overwhelming assumption is that those things are watched live.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what you
numbers count,
but I watch almost nothing on time anymore. I mean, even the stuff that I watch on the same day that it comes out, I'll time delay it so I can skip the commercials.
Which is, we're the people that the TV companies hate.
Yes.
Because the whole reason it's on TV is like, it's all advertising, and we're not participating in their system.
By the way, the Not a Thing podcast is looking for sponsors. So if any of you TV commercial creators or ad companies are you're feeling the hurt on TV, come to us. Come to the podcast. We'd love to have you.
Some listenership.
Hey, our listenership is great. I think it's wonderful. Not a thing podcast listeners are 100% better than non-Not a Thing podcast listeners.
That's just a scientific fact. That's just good science.
Pretty much. I'm sure there's a study that backs this up. We could find one on the internet. Like,
we should set up a link to a page we've created. It just has like a thumbs up. Podcast listeners. That's it. Just like a GIF.
But yeah, anyway, the article's really good. It's a bit long. I don't know. Did you catch it at all? Or
I read most of it, but it looked like there was multiple articles going on in the same article. It wasn't just about Nielsen ratings.
Yeah, it wasn't just about Nielsen ratings. It was more about and it wasn't specifically that TV companies were getting smarter about it. It's just that there's more options for getting data than the Nielsen ratings. And so it talked about there were, I guess Twitter had recently purchased a company that does social media metrics and would, I mean, it's not just counting hashtags, although it almost is just that sometimes. It's as simple as that, as figuring out like what people are talking about and tracking that data. I mean, that's one dimension of it, right? I mean, not everybody's on Twitter, but it is a good, I mean, if you're not tracking anything, tracking at least Twitter will give you some of a picture of what kind of popularity is there,
the cultural impact.
Yeah, and I think that's really what's interesting about what they can glean from it. I mean, you can see popularity. The interesting thing that comes from that is, what do you do with that information? It's like, sure, it's popular, but how do you, you know, they're always looking at how do they monetize that? And that's a subject for another show. I don't know.
The Art and Commerce podcast.
Yes. I think that stuff has to get figured out too. I mean, I think moving it away from the Nielsen ratings might mean that more shows get correctly picked up or funded, or, and then hopefully it means that some shows get panned and destroyed because they're just awful and filler. But I think you know, the producing the content has to, that stuff has been going up as of late. I mean, there's a lot more decent TV on, or at least it feels like that to me.
There's a lot of really crappy TV out there too.
That's true.
Have you been watching the new season of Community?
I just saw the Halloween one. I haven't seen all of them. Okay. So I'm a little ways behind. I mean, it's funny that they showed the Halloween one in like February, but
right.
That's NBC for you. But
I still watch the show. I still love the show. But I don't think it's as funny without Dan Harmon.
No, you can tell. It feels different, and I know that
it feels less organic.
Yeah, it feels a bit more programmed. About like not quite on autopilot, but it doesn't feel as authentic as it did. I mean, there's obviously some ridiculous stuff that happens, but even the ridiculous stuff had kind of a thing behind it that you could sense. And in this, it just feels like the jokes are coming from like a similar like motivation. Like you knew that this was where this joke came from, because that's the joke they made, you know, over the last 2 years, and we'll just recycle it. Although I don't know. I think it's interesting they're pushing more of an arc this season, it seems, like the Jeff's dad kind of stuff. Although I'm not caught up. I know that they're further along than
there's some resolution with that.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, I should get on that. I still think it's a good show, but I definitely like the earlier seasons compared to this one. So,
Have you seen anything else recently that you may have liked or not liked?
Why, yes, indeed. I saw the premiere of Bates Motel. It's on A&E, I think, on Monday, and it's I'm not sure what his role is, but it's put together by Carlton Cuse. Am I mm-hmm. doing that right?
Yep.
The guy from Lost, or not mm-hmm. the guy from Lost, but the creator of Lost.
One of the executive producers of Lost.
Yeah. And I didn't watch Lost, so so I
and
might
you
be
a... always have a hole in your heart because you have not filled it with Lost. So, you know, everybody's broken in some way.
Yeah.
Well, and I did watch the show. That hole in my heart was filled, and I've been broken in a different way by the ending of Lost.
Yeah, I've heard good things about Lost, and then also bad things about Lost. So I think that's I actually, on the whole, that's good. That generally means that if it has kind of a high points and low points, that means it's at least emotionally invested for people, that you can feel you know, a range, and it's not just this kind of one note about everything. But the Bates Motel was quite good. I mean, I'm a fan of Hitchcock and the original Psycho. Actually never saw the shot for shot remake that was done.
Well, you kind of did,
yeah,
because you saw the original.
Yeah, I was about to say that. The I know that they updated kind of the look of it a little bit. So what was interesting, I think the most interesting thing to me about the Bates Motel show, and I think the characters were really well done, especially the guy playing Norman Bates. I don't remember his name, but he was apparently Charlie from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the new one. But anyway, the thing that was great about him was that his characterization of Norman is really well done. There's a scene when he's at the very beginning of the show and he's crying and kind of in anguish, and the way that, like, kind of he's contorting his face, he looks just like Norman from the end of the Psycho film, when it all kind of goes to hell and he's exposed for who he is. It's really just
spoilers.
Yeah, it's good though. You should watch it, totally. Maybe not the new remake, but so what I was saying was the interesting thing about it is in the show, they kind of don't tell you what the time frame is. I mean, everyone is kind of wearing I guess 2013-ish kind of clothes, except Norma, the mother, and Norman, who are wearing clothes kind of more appropriate to when the movie came out. Which is interesting. It's kind of like time bending a little bit about the time frame. And I think there is an iPhone or a smartphone that looks a lot like an iPhone in a couple of the shots. So they're kind of updating it time frame wise to now. But I think it's interesting because it makes the show feel, or it makes, I think it makes the movie feel more timeless, because in the movie, I don't think there's really anything that would have been necessarily enhanced by technology. It's not like, you know, oh, if only he had a cell phone, this never would have happened or anything like that. So I think it shows how strong the movie was from a storytelling perspective, from a timeless storytelling perspective. But the show obviously has to breathe its own kind of life into it. And so updating it so it can have more modern conceits in it isn't bad necessarily. I just have to see how it goes. I like the moodiness of it and the setup and the characters. I actually wouldn't mind it if it were not a direct prequel to the movie. I don't think it can be time-wise because the Norman is much too young to be the Norman from the movie, or at least I think so. I hope it's not, you know, directly, you know, a prequel to the movie, because I think there's a lot of potential for having stories that kind of build that character without necessarily resolving into the movie like right away.
So it's like Psycho Smallville.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And just like the way Smallville, like it, I mean, there was a point in Smallville where it's like, okay, he's Superman. It's for real now. We're not, you know, there's not a, you know, he's yeah, not figuring like it out.
8 or 9 years before that happened.
Right. Right. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot of good, a good richness they can pull into it. I think it will be difficult to keep the moody mood of it without it being depressing is the word that I can think of, just because it is you know, the relationship, you know, the mother-son relationship was kind of like the background to the movie, and it's the foreground of this show. So it's it'll be interesting to see how much they can develop that without it, you know, kind of burning people out.
Well, this is the same channel. E&E is the same channel that has Intervention. So the bar is pretty low for depressing and getting burned out on downer stuff. Actually, the bar would be really high. Sorry.
Well, I think it'll do well. I hope it, it at least runs for the season, to see, how things go. Anyway, it's only got one episode under its belt, so it's not, by any stretch of the imagination, like, you know, the most wonderful you-have-to-watch-it thing ever. But it's good. It's good. What else did I kind of see this week that was interesting? Oh, I saw Ted, finally.
What did you think?
It was good. It was very Seth MacFarlane-y.
Yeah.
I said this when we talked about, because I feel like we talked about the movie a little bit when you saw it.
I think we did, yeah.
But I really did like the way they animated the just Ted the bear. It took me almost zero time to suspend disbelief about the you know, oh, that's just a character and. It's, you know, he's interacting with people and that's it. Like, I'm not staring at it and being like, oh, how did they do this and how did this work. It's like, no, that's just another character in the movie. So
that there's no Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah. Whew. No, thankfully. Oh, and I also saw Primer, which was a weird movie. Had you heard of that, or do you know about it?
I actually saw it, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
and
it's
all I remember is it made my brain hurt trying to figure out what was going on.
Definitely.
But I liked it.
Yeah, it's a hard movie to kind of... I found it was a hard movie to explain to somebody else without giving away stuff. So... So don't read anything about it if you're thinking of of maybe picking it up. I know it's on Netflix, so if you got that Netflix instant watch kind of action, you can find it. But do not read anything about it before seeing it. But one thing I will say is don't do anything else when you're trying to watch it.
No, so you gotta focus.
I was typing up something for work. And I, you know, it was a Saturday and I'm just like, oh, I'll watch this. I had gotten a couple of good recommendations from it from people. And I guess the, writer, director, actor from it, his new film, Upstream Color, just premiered at South by Southwest. And so one of my coworkers was like, oh, I saw his new movie. It's great. You should watch the old one and the new one. I love everything he's done. You know, it was kind of this raving review. So I'm like, okay, I'll watch it. But after maybe the first 15 minutes, I was realizing I'm missing things. So I had to put down my my laptop and spin the show back and watch it over again. I mean, it's really dense. It's got a lot of stuff going on. It's really easy to miss what's going on, but I think the payoff is good. I mean, if you like a movie that'll kind of mess you up mentally just by keeping track of stuff, then it's definitely this. Like I compare it kind of to Memento, or to a lesser extent Inception. I think Inception has more kind of obvious set pieces about things, but it's more like Memento, where they don't really give you all of the information about what's going on. You just kind of are experiencing it, and then, you know, after maybe a third of the movie, you're like, oh, that's what's happening. And if you can, you know, track it a little bit, it catches up. And I felt the same thing about Primer. Good though. The one thing that I think that it doesn't spoil about the movie that is nice is that the setup is it's a bunch of either friends or coworkers or something of people that are essentially working in a garage trying to invent something. And, you know, being from Silicon Valley, where so much of that kind of culture comes from, it was neat to see kind of that evolution of their idea. But it's really it looks like the main plot, and it's really kind of a side plot, which is also interesting. I mean, the movie kind of takes its own turns and stuff like that, and apparently it was made for like almost no money.
$0.
Yeah, pretty good for what it was. So that's my stuff. I don't know.
Did I say anything? I saw Wreck-It Ralph finally.
Oh yeah, how was that?
I enjoyed it.
Okay,
it was, you know, a kid's movie.
Okay, so
but it's cool to see all the video game stuff all under one roof.
Yeah, that's the main thing that I've heard that people like from it. Is it too much of a kid's movie to watch? Like, do you get like
it didn't. I don't think it's as well layered as the Pixar movies are, where they're really designed for everybody.
Yeah,
and there was a lot of stuff in it that older watchers would get,
mm-hmm.
but the sensibility is still very much a kid's movie.
Okay. Oh, well, I'll probably still pick it up because I'm enough of a video game fan. I would like it. But
one of the video games is called Sugar Rush. And so it's basically like being in Candyland. And all I could think while I was watching is, I really want to go get some candy.
They got to work that cross-promotion stuff a little better then, I think.
Need that Wonka vision. I want a candy bar through my TV.
Cool. Well, I think that's all she wrote this week. Unless you have anything else, Brennan, I don't know.
No, I'm done talking to these people.
Yeah. Right on.
I'm kidding. I meant that in a nice way.
No, we're giving back, you know, time for everyone to do other things this week.
Right.
Right. They should be thankful.
Okay, well, I say we just stop the podcast now. We only have 2 feet each to put in our mouth, so I'm out of shoes.
Right on.
Until next time.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.